The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and in your life. Yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey, Julie.
Our guest today on Getting to Yes And is Dick Costel. Dick is a venture partner at Index Ventures and the chief executive and co-founder of a startup that is reimagining the path to personal fitness. Costello was most recently chief executive of Twitter from 2010 to 2015. Prior to joining Twitter, Dick co-founded and ran three startups, including FeedBurner, which sold to Google in 2007. Dick holds a BS in computer science from the University of Michigan, but he began his career right here in Chicago, where he was a proud member of the Chicago improvisational scene. Dick Costello, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Kelly.
So I first encountered you as a writer-performer in a fantastic show in the mid-1990s called Modern Problems in Science.
Yes, you did. Yeah.
And I found a review of the show by Jack Helbig in The Reader that when I read it, I actually thought was kind of insightful, maybe in terms of the path that your career took. And I'm just going to quote Jack's review, where he says, using every intellectual weapon at their disposal, sarcasm, outrageous puns, digressive storytelling, exceptionally complicated diagrams on the blackboard, these funny, verbally facile performers spoof sloppy thinking, popular culture, and the foibles of academics, and draw sellout crowds on a Tuesday night. Their secret, they think too much, therefore they are too much.
That's gotten me. You can't believe, you wouldn't believe how far that's gotten me.
It's kind of, right? I mean, it's like Jack was seeing things.
I just stuck with that the whole way.
There you go. It was a great show. And I believe you went to Edinburgh with that show.
We did. We took it to the Edinburgh. We took it a bunch of places. We took it to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. And we were in this tiny little, one of those tiny little out of the way theaters there. There are like 50 or 60 theaters that pop up during that Fringe Festival. It got a bunch of attention there in that tiny space, and then we went back the next year into a bigger space, and it was a big hit. So that was a lot of fun. We ended up taking it all over the world to the Montreal Comedy Festival and on and on and on. That was a great show. It was a great deal of fun.
Yeah.
Rich Fulcher of the Mighty Boosh fame, also one of the cast members.
Yeah, Rich, amazing work for Second City briefly. And I mean, that it was such a golden era for you to be here in Chicago. And kind of interesting that you had your feet in these two worlds. And certainly at that point, I think the improvisational world was well known, right? It was already famous. But in the sort of like startup tech world, I don't think Chicago at that period, unless you can correct me on this, was recognized as being much of a hotbed.
No, few to zero, even Web1.0 companies in Chicago. A couple of the big web consulting firms like US Web and the like, but none of the really big, none of the stuff that was happening in New York or certainly out here in San Francisco at the time. So I had a lot of friends in the improv community. It really was sort of the golden era of improv in Chicago. So many of those folks have gone on to do amazing things. Everyone from Mick, of course, Napier, and Carell and I were in the same Second City Training Center group when we first started. Steve and I went through all the levels together there. But that whole crew was fantastic. But I was one of the only people in the tech startup scene.
And I will also go out on a limb and say probably the only one in the improv world even slightly remotely interested in fitness.
even remotely interested in fitness. No, I would go for a run. People would, like, what
are you doing?
What are you trying to get to?
Yeah, really. I mean, like, even the tech thing was, like, closer to them. Like, oh, yeah, I'm not getting fitness? No.
That was a lot of, that was a great deal of confusion about that.
So this, but I mean, but
why would you use this time of day to run in a circle where you end up where you started?
Right. When you could be sleeping.
Yeah. When you could be sleeping. That's precisely right.
So I bring this up because your latest project is looking at scaling this emerging phenomenon of group fitness. And I'm very interested in this because we do a lot of work with the behavioral science community at the University of Chicago, and they talk a lot about getting you to do stuff by having someone else there pushing you to do it.
Yep. The thing that I noticed about all the digital fitness platforms is they were essentially like gym memberships. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is a gym membership, people sign up for a gym membership on January 1st because they make a New Year's resolution to themselves. There's no social accountability or social pressure to use the gym membership, so they never go. And by Valentine's Day, the gym is back down to the size it was at the beginning of the year, a mere 6 weeks later. So when we found also by doing a ton of social behavioral science research, people break promises to themselves far faster than they will break a promise to somebody they have even a remote social connectivity to. So we are spending the time at this company building basically a social accountability platform for people trying to get in shape and people trying to lead healthier lives by connecting small, intimate groups of people together to hold each other accountable to achieving their goals.
And you've carried this theme with you through your whole work career. Didn't you build a gym when you were at Twitter for the employees?
I did. Yeah. I built a gym at Twitter for a couple reasons. One, in these sort of ad hoc, random fitness classes that some of the people I worked with would go to, I noticed that it was the only place that people from different functions in the company really hung out. You know, the engineers would eat lunch with other engineers. The salespeople would eat lunch with other salespeople. Right. They would go do things after work socially with the people in their group. But in these gym classes, you would end up with people from sales and engineering and finance and accounting and on, all in the same room. And I thought that was great and important. And I wanted to make sure more of that was happening. So we built a gym inside the Twitter headquarters and had classes there sort of morning and evening. And it was really the place where people from different parts of the company would get together. And the great thing about that was, you know, if you're just hanging out with, heck, the American political system is like this now. If you're just hanging out with the people who do what you do in engineering, you end up saying things like, I wonder what the heck all those people over in sales do all day. They don't look like they're working as hard as we are, the gym facilitated getting those different people from those different groups together. And then, you know, you would hopefully have someone in that engineering room who would say, well, actually, I'm in this gym class with a couple people in the sales organization, and they sound like they're working their ass off. So it was great for that kind of both in-room social pressure to do what you needed to do during the class, but also just helping everybody else in the company understand each other.
Yeah, so you got tons of benefits because you're de-siloing. The studies are out there that regular workouts make you more productive and happier.
Yep, that's right.
And the other thing that's interesting, just in our backgrounds, is I think when you work in improvisation, one of the byproducts is that you really start to understand this really, I'll call it a lovely tension between the individual and the group. And that can be your own group, but then it extends to the audience because you're crowdsourcing your stuff, right? Your material.
Right.
And then you look at where we've gone with social and those worlds speak to each other, I think. There's something in the sort of orientation that makes you, I think, appreciate a group dynamic in a way that maybe other folks who haven't had that experience, maybe they don't.
Yep, I completely agree with you.
I heard through the grapevine that you have an incredibly competitive workout partner who may or may not be a prominent California politician. I mean, we can leave it there.
You must be talking about Gavin Newsom.
Yes.
He's in much better shape than I am.
Yeah. The rumor I heard is that like you guys have like a coach who doesn't need to be there because the two of you are so competitive against each other.
It's good that the coach is there for all sorts of reasons.
Okay. Yeah.
But Gavin is in extraordinary shape, much better than I am.
And he might be our next governor of California.
Well, I hope so. We'll see. I'm a very, very big fan of his.
Speaking of, we were sort of referencing social, and I talked about the idea that Second City has been crowdsourcing since 1959, and social media has created this whole new level of open communication between brands and consumers. How much of when you were doing your work in this area, were you top of mind drawing on this stuff, or was it more in the background in terms of how your improvisational training might inform your work in the area of social?
Well, I'll tell you, it vividly informed my work as a leader of a very large tech company for all sorts of reasons. One is that, in my view, great leaders are great listeners. I mean, Andy Grove writes about this in his management book that's, it's decades old now out here, but it's one of the sort of the seminal works in management out here. He talks about listening being 70% of what great managers do. I totally agree with that.
Yeah.
And going into a room as a leader, knowing that the best ideas can come from anywhere in the company, and that paying attention closely to what people are saying and synthesizing decisions for them when you make decisions based on what you heard them tell you, even if they disagree with your decision, if you can explain it to them in the context of what you heard them tell you, those decisions are far more likely to be committed to. They're far more likely to be embraced by the team than if you sort of make some decision and communicate it without having listened to or gathered any feedback on it. So all of the skills you learned on stage about listening and, another one is 100%, understanding when someone in the company tells you something, when somebody in the company makes an initiation, accepting that initiation as their reality instead of explaining why that's not the case.
Yeah.
Makes you 1,000% more effective leader, right? You'll see leaders that deny what their people say or ignore it and then wonder why people are unhappy or claim that that's just not true. There is no such problem. Those are teams and organizations and companies that aren't nearly as effective as companies where the leader is accepting what people tell him or her as their reality and dealing with it.
Yeah, because I think people forget that when they're saying no to an idea, they're also saying no to a person. And you say no to a person enough, they're going to stop giving you any more ideas.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I can't tell you how many example after example you hear of leaders and managers not just saying no to things, but sort of ignoring it or denying there's a problem and being defensive about it. And that sort of rejection of the other person's reality just creates misery for that team.
Totally. I found another link to improv and something you said. You once said, quote, "One of the greatest things you can do as a leader is to give employees informal, in-the-moment specific praise." And
right.
That's so much like side coaching in early improv, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a tool that managers and leaders use the least. That's one of the most effective and least expensive, just in terms of time and energy and preparation. When you give people in the moment informal feedback about a job well done, in front of the group, in front of their peers, that's one of the most motivating things you can do. And it's another one of these areas where I'm just surprised how infrequently it's done.
Yeah. What's your take on performance reviews?
I'll tell you, I'm I'm of two minds about performance reviews.
Okay.
On the one hand, you know, people want feedback. They great performers, great people, great contributors want to understand how they're doing and want to know how they can be better. Mm-hmm. The challenge is these performance reviews usually have so much overhead and human resources burden associated with sort of logging and writing everything down and making sure you heard something, any sort of negative criticism from more than three people and X, Y, Z, that they just become these, and they're usually tied to compensation. So they just become these really overwrought and overloaded human resources mechanisms. So I don't think, for whatever reason, I think it remains an unsolved problem that needs additional work.
Yeah, one of the scientists that we work with, we got a partnership with the Center for Decision Research at Chicago Booth. His specialty is feedback, and the two areas of study that he basically thinks he knows is that beginners just need encouragement. So that's that kind of side coaching and what you just talked about. And experts need challenges. And the problem is what to do with everyone else, which is most of everyone who are in the middle, because they're just going to – you can say – 90 great things and then one bad thing, and they're going to hold on to the bad thing. That's just a human brain.
Of course. It's really this remains, I think, one of the great unsolved HR or people management challenges nothing I've seen out there has done a good job of dealing with this.
No. So I was just on Twitter, as I'm prone to be, and you're still on there doing a lot of stuff. And I'm curious, you once said authenticity is absolutely the key to a great tweet. And I wanted to unpack, I think I know what you mean, but I wanted to unpack it a little bit because, I mean, you've lived and breathed this 24/7 in your life. And obviously Twitter is so in the news for so many different reasons, not the least of which is our government seems to be running on it. So I think it comes down to a matter of context is mostly where I find that people make their biggest tweeting errors.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. How much time do we have?
Let's see.
I could talk about this for hours, but I'll tell you what I meant, what I generally meant by that is people are a lot better, I think, today than maybe even 30, 40 years ago at detecting an inauthentic tone of voice. At detecting marketing or at detecting, wait a minute, that doesn't sound like that person. And they really turn off from it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'll tell you I could go through example after example, but you'll see corporate Twitter accounts where, 15, 14, I have a 15-year-old, so I'll use him as an example. Mm-hmm. You can see corporate Twitter accounts where, or Instagram accounts, pick your media platform, where 15-year-olds will be able to look at that account and say, this is the marketing department, and this over here is someone else, and I've tuned that out. It happens with politicians where people can tell this isn't really that person. This is some, there's three different voices speaking here. You compare that to go look at any TV advertisement from 40 years ago. You've got this like inauthenticity blaring out at you and people just took it in. Now they spot it a mile away and they tune it out. They feel like that's not really coming from that entity and I don't believe anything it says anymore.
And this is where your comedy experience and expertise comes into play, because so many marketers use comedy and they have no training in comedy.
Yeah. I mean, the worst, we've all seen this. You go to some conference and the speaker gets up there and they feel like they've got to start with a joke. And it's just the most painful thing you can, you're really like looking down at your feet, wanting it to be over. And, it's just inauthentic, it's another version of inauthenticity. Like, you shouldn't start with it. I don't know who told you to do that, but don't do it.
Don't do it. Don't do it. Yeah. So I think that comes down to also understanding what your comic POV is, what your comic voice is.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and there's some brands, you know, I mean, there's some interesting chances that brands have taken now, allowing themselves to maybe not appeal to everyone and understanding that they can be a little risky with their comedy. I'm thinking of some brands that have, you know, they'll troll people, you know, a little bit themselves. Yeah.
I think that, that's what people love that.
Yeah.
People love that because they feel like, This is something that's not trying to now be all things to all people. It is taking a chance on doing something a little bit out on a limb. They like that those brands are taking. They like that the brands are taking chances. It makes them feel like there are real people behind them and not just some engine that's trying to optimize for appealing to the largest number of folks. That kind of thing can, obviously it's risky, but it can really, really work for brands. And I've seen it over and over on Twitter.
Now, another area tied to this that you had to deal with, and you still are dealing with it because you've talked about it, is this whole area around ethics and Twitter and how you control what certain people say or don't control, hate speech, blocking, all that stuff. I mean, I don't know. It's interesting. I have something I want to share with you in terms of improvisation and ethics, but it feels to me like that is one of the trickiest areas that you found yourself in the middle of in your time at the company.
Yeah, I'll tell you, everyone thinks they have an easy solution to the problem that hasn't worked on it. And, and they wonder why Twitter hasn't just done X, Y, Z. And those are all things everybody in the company has thought of 20 times and is working on. The challenge is everything from, you'll hear things like, well, you just shouldn't let people say, use this kind of language. Well, some of that language that kind of language sometimes is a line from a poem or a line from a song. And now are you going to prevent people from quoting that song? People shouldn't be able to people shouldn't be able to say this kind of thing to somebody because it's offensive. Well, in the context of reacting to a politician who's done something that a constituent finds offensive, that reaction may be, not just protected political speech, but encourage appropriate political speech. So it's, there aren't, all by way of saying, there aren't one size fits all solutions to this. And that's what makes it so challenging at scale, is you can't just say, well, just apply this rule to every single account. You have to take these things in the context of, you have to understand the speech in the context of how it's being used. You've got things like, you've even got organizations like, Scientology, who for as one example, there are a bunch of people in the world who feel it's a way of life for them and their beginning and their ending. And there are a bunch of other people who feel like, it's this completely different thing and needs to be treated as differently, and it should be talked about a certain way. And both those groups of people are convinced that, their way of thinking about these things is okay, and the other way of thinking about it is not okay. And there are just lots of things like that out there.
Yeah, there's two ways that this kind of touches in our improvisational work, and it's one, creating a space where you can have difficult conversations, creating a space where my wife always quotes this, and she's a comedy professor of Carlin. But a lot of people quote George Carlin as saying, I go up to the line and I cross it. They stop the quote there. But there's a second part to that quote, which is and then I ask the audience to cross it with me and make it make them glad they came. That's the part people don't. Yeah. It's like, that's the difference. Right. So and then the other aspect I was going to bring up to you, because I found this very interesting. I had to do some work in We got hired to do an improvisation and ethics program, and I actually discovered a book by Sam Wells, who I quote a bunch on this podcast. We actually had him on. He's a reverend who's also a scholar, and he wrote a book on Christian ethics and improvisation, and I'll quote him. He said, Christian ethics and theatrical improvisation are both about years of steeping in a tradition so that the body is so soaked in practices and perceptions that it trusts itself in community to do the obvious thing.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, it's great. That's great.
So, for my sort of thinking with this is the one thing about the sort of improvisational practice is it does force you to always be considering the other, even if the other is the most bizarre thing you think you've ever seen.
Yeah. I mean, the greatest scenes I ever witnessed in the late hours of the night at Second City were those scenes that started off under an improv set into the like where in the what in the world is happening, and those end up being some of the greatest all-time improv scenes you've ever seen. And you can imagine not trusting the process and not wanting the thing to, oh my gosh, we're this crazy thing's about to happen, prevent it from spinning out of control, and trying to rein it in. That's a great quote.
I want to, before we're getting close to wrapping up, but I want to ask you, you've consulted on Silicon Valley, the HBO show, right?
I did. Season 3, last year.
Yep. Last year. All right. So love that show. And I guess I want to ask you how close
some good Chicago yes. folks on there. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. How close to reality is that show?
So close to reality.
Oh no.
So close to reality that people in the Valley regularly approach me, not exaggerating, and say, yeah, that show's great. I can't watch it because it gives me PTSD and I have it's too real. So I literally can't watch it because it ends up hurting me to look at the screen while it's on. So it's remarkably close to reality.
That's the same thing that every political figure I know in Washington says about Veep.
Yeah, it's even the case that they being the writers of Silicon Valley, will try to come up with things that are absurd. And it, of course, as you can imagine, ends up being something that's precisely what's being done.
I remember I read this. I forget where I read this, that some of the writers were in a conference room where Astro Teller was kind of getting mad at them. And then after he gave his speech, he went to leave, but he was still wearing his rollerblades. So it was really awkward.
Got up and rollerbladed out.
So that really did happen?
As I understand it, that really did happen. Yeah.
I love it. Okay, so the way we end our podcast,
I'll tell you one quick thing,
please,
about a great sort of juxtaposition of Southern California and the writing room at Silicon Valley versus the real Silicon Valley. One of the things that the folks involved with the show find endlessly amusing is that whenever they're up here talking to companies and doing research for the show, the companies inevitably say, you know, well, here at company X, we're changing the world. And they just think it's hilarious that every single company that they walk into, irrespective of whether, what they're doing, is entirely convinced that what they're doing is making the world a better place.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of distinction between, what the folks up here in Silicon Valley are working on and believe they're working on, and the perception of it down there in the writer's room is something.
That's awesome. And that is the fertile ground of comedy right there, the chasm between
them.
Yeah.
Yep.
So I want to ask you, and this is kind of I'm throwing you a softball here, because we always end with asking the guest for a yes and story. And you have a million of them. You've lived your life as a yes and. But is there a time you
I'll
can
give you? I'll
get.
Give you a really good one.
Good.
There was a, and as kind of gets back to my point about the greatest scenes at Second City during an improv set when something was seemed like completely outrageous.
Yep.
In July of 2009, my wife and I were out here in San Francisco for a weekend visiting friends, and got back to Chicago and it was boiling hot as it is in Chicago in the summer. And both said to our said to each other, you know, we should just move out to San Francisco. And I was getting ready to start a new company with one of my Feedburner co-founders in Chicago. We had already incorporated the company and we're getting ready to get down to work. And instead, we woke up the next morning, put our house on the market, sold it in a day, moved out to California. Our daughter was at summer camp. So our daughter came back from summer camp, had left 2 weeks earlier, being a resident of Chicago, and came back from summer camp, and there was a sold sign in the front yard of the house. We told her we were moving to San Francisco. And at the same time, about 3 days later, after we decided to move, Ev Williams sent me a direct message on Twitter and said, hey, I'm going on, I'm going to take a few weeks off for paternity leave when my son is born in a few weeks. Would you be interested in coming out here and for a few weeks and just helping help manage the company while I'm out? And I said, yes, in fact, I'm going to be moving out there. And he asked me, well, what if actually, given that you're going to be moving out there, what if you actually came in and were COO of the company? And again, I sort of just looked at my wife and said, well, we're already moving out there, and chances to get involved with companies like this come along once in a lifetime. So let's just go for it. So that was a huge, an obvious no, we can't move. It's the middle of summer. Our daughter starts school in 6 weeks. We haven't even thought about where we would live. Became a very, very big yes and.
That's a great story. The whole Twitter thing was a yes and. That's
and
continues to be. I mean, I think both in terms of what you're doing with your career, which is building on passions you have and skills you possess, and also the way you talk about leadership and the idea of being present and resilient, I think are very powerful messages. And I thank you so much for sharing them because I think they're really important right now.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Kelly. It was fun.